Now, local control is the idea that local government officials can make decisions independently for their own communities, as opposed to state or federal control. Our next guest says that local control here in Wisconsin has lost a lot of its meaning. He did a survey of local government officials, finding that a lot of them don't even agree on the definition of local control, or think it's a great idea, but they say they don't have that much power in practice, or they say it's just become a political football. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see your local or county government have more control over decision-making? If so, on what kind of stuff? Taxes, the environment, gun laws, drug laws, schools? Where do you think the state needs to take the lead? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Ford is director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy and an associate professor of public administration at UW-Oshkosh. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with this research you did, a survey of local officials. Who did you go out and talk to? What were you trying to find out?
Yeah, so this really came to light during the kind of the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. There was a lot of talk about who should be in control of the state response. And we found that a lot of people were claiming local control or advocating for it without defining it. So we went out and surveyed 288 municipal managers and other local government leaders around the state and basically just asked them, how do they define local control? What's working? What's not?
What were some of the most striking things you heard from them?
The one thing that stood out among, greater than anything else was that this concept has been weaponized for political purposes. So in fact, it really has no actionable meaning.
Talk about that a little more, because we've heard accusations that, we've heard from these politicians that they like local control. But then a particular issue comes up. Maybe it's the state's gun or drug laws or environmental regulations or whatever. And then they might work on state legislation that overrides it. Can you talk about the political football that a lot of these local officials see?
Yeah, I mean, the real thing that stood out was, again, the lack of a universal definition of local control. So, for example, during the COVID-19 response, we got all kinds of split answers. I wish that there was more state control over masking policy so we didn't have to deal with it. But then you had other areas of the state where it was exactly the opposite, that, hey, we didn't want to do any shutdowns. The state made us. So there really was just this lack of meaning. So everyone was complaining about local control, the balance of local control being out of whack, but no one really had a specific definition of what that meant. And really what that does is it grinds government to a halt. How do you implement this core foundational concept in Wisconsin government if we're all over the map on what it means?
Do you see a core definition of local control that we could use as an operating term?
See, broadly, I mean, the idea is that state-level issues are decided by the state, local-level issues are decided by the local government.
That
sounds
easy, huh?
Really good, right? Right? Good things are good. I'd say, who doesn't like rainbows and butterflies? So, I don't think there is one great definition. So our takeaway was that local governments need to stop arguing with each other about what local control means and really work a definition into their budgets, into their strategic planning, into their core documents. So at the very least, when they're negotiating with the state about an appropriate level of local control, they're on the same page.
What are some issues that seem to be pretty cut and dried state issues, like where people generally are going to agree that these policies have to come from the state and local governments are all kind of playing on the same field?
Correct. So higher ed was one of the big ones that is clearly a statewide issue. K-12 education was interesting. And I think because we were surveying mostly municipalities and we weren't talking to school districts, they definitely felt that it was more of a statewide issue. But when you start looking at things like land use, zoning and revenue limits, taxation, that's when the local governments really thought that, hey, this should be our purview, not the state's.
And then how about what's at the end where everybody agrees this is a local issue?
Well, the big one was revenue limits and taxation options. Local government leaders definitely feel like they don't have much power over how they raise the revenue that they spend locally.
Are there messages you see out of here that you think state lawmakers say or governors or other people making policy at the state level should hear and try to at least think about and pay attention to?
Well, I think the big thing is that they need to understand that local governments are losing their trust and losing their faith in the capacity of state government to give them meaningful power. And why that's so consequential is it puts local government in purely reactive mode, and that erodes trust and ultimately is fiscally irresponsible.
Michael Ford is with us, director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy and associate professor of political administration at UW Oshkosh. We're talking to him about local government control in Wisconsin. He surveyed a bunch of local government leaders around the state, found confusion, some disagreement, some skepticism about local control and how it's used as a political weapon in some ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The U.S. is unique in a lot of ways in its high level of local control over things like K-12 schools. Do you think local control of schools is a good or bad thing? Do you want to have consistent statewide standards, more of them, fewer of them? In general, what do you think should be the job of your local government? When do you think the state should take charge? How about things like a pandemic response? Did you want to see more from the state or leave local officials to make those key decisions? Call 800-642-1234. If you work in local government, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're picking up our conversation with Michael Ford with UW Oshkosh, associate professor there of public administration, looking at the state of local government control in Wisconsin, what it means. He did a survey of local elected officials, found a lot of different opinions, some confusion, some skepticism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there an issue in your own community where you want to see the local government have more or less power to decide what's going on? 800-642-1234 is the number. Elizabeth is on the line with us in Ellison Bay. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi there. We have a lack of local control here on an issue that is literally destroying the fabric of our entire community here in Door County. I've been screaming about it for a while, and I'm really happy that you're talking about this. A few years ago in Wisconsin, there was some clever maneuvering. There was a local control issue on the subject of Airbnbs in another community in the northern part of the state. And in the last minute, they made a rule change. We lost all local control of Airbnbs in the state of Wisconsin, which is not how it operates in most states. So right now, Airbnbs are taking over our ability. How do I put this? We had so many people purchasing properties here from the West Coast, for example, the last couple of years. They buy them. They can absolutely outbid any local folks because of the difference in income. And they buy them. They pop them up. They're Airbnbs. They make money. And no one here can afford homes anymore. We're looking at 40 and 50% increase in our property values, which means that I have five kids. Do they get to live here? Do we get to live here? This is a lack of local control. And essentially, when someone is allowed to just buy a building and turn it into a commercial business in the middle of a residential area, we're giving special privileges to a select group of well-heeled people, and we aren't allowing our communities to say, hey, this doesn't work here. We don't want to do this anymore. So.
Elizabeth, thanks a lot for the call. Michael, a great example that she's right, that state law overrode local government's abilities to put the kibosh on things like Airbnb in a community. The classic arguments, local governments should have the ability to do these things, but you could say, well, hold on, companies should be able to deal on level playing field in whatever community they're trying to do business in the state. What do you think of that as an example?
Oh, yes, yeah, such a great example. And it illustrates that, you know, how when we give up local control, we lose the power to differentiate the way we regulate. Door County and the Airbnb situation in Door County is different than the Airbnb situation where I am in Oshkosh. It's going to be different in, southeastern Wisconsin. When we take something that really has local elements, we make it a statewide issue, we lose that ability to differentiate, and that has consequences. So great example.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Michael, do you think there needs to be more communication between local elected officials and state lawmakers who are passing bills like this? Do you think there is this kind of communication? What did you hear from the people you surveyed?
there definitely is communication, but it's very much this, it's not divide and conquer, but it's local governments negotiating with themselves. When they're not on the same page, they're not in agreement, or maybe they're just not right in understanding exactly where they have control and don't have control. It gives state legislators the ability to say, well, heck, you know, you're asking for different things. We don't know what you want. So we're going to keep going down the road we're going. And that road has been pretty significantly in favor of state control over more and more every year.
Was there at some point, Michael, a consistent philosophy that said this issue goes in the bucket of local control, this one goes in the state? Have things changed a lot in the last couple of decades?
So the basic idea, there's a court ruling going back to, I believe, the 19th century called Dillon's Rule. And the concept there is that local government has powers that are given to them by the state, powers that are fairly implied or those that are necessary for their function. And it's that third bucket where we've really had the erosion of local control, whereas the state used to really give a lot of power to local governments to determine what exactly is something they need, a power they need to function day to day. That has disappeared as the state has gotten more and more involved in things like, you know, election administration, zoning and land use, regulation, like the example that was just given over things like Airbnb, emerging issues. So that kind of classic definition really has changed over time.
Do you think it needs to change back?
I do. And I do think that part of the problem here is that we have these local governments that are nonpartisan that are increasingly being subjected to partisan politics. And you're starting to see some of those state partisan issues trickle in to local governments. So whereas you might have had a unified front at the local level that this is clearly a municipal issue and we're all in agreement, you have these new partisan fault lines that I think are changing the debate and really tipping it in favor of the state.
Yeah, we heard from Mark in Fort Atkinson who said we can help keep government control local by keeping outside of district money from flowing into elections. So people, maybe those partisan donors from outside of, say, a city or a county getting involved. Do you see that being part of what's driving what you just mentioned, the partisanization, if I can make up a word, of local government?
Yeah. You know, I can't speak directly to if it's the money coming in, but it certainly is, you know, more and more political party involvement in nonpartisan elections and more things like candidate trainings and things that on the surface aren't bad. But when we start to have some of that Republican Democrat versus Democrat dynamic at the local level, we see some of the dysfunction I think we see at the state level filter into the local level. And that makes it harder for local government to coalesce around key concepts like local control.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Ford is the director of the Whitburn Center for Governance and Policy and an associate professor of public administration at UW Oshkosh. He wrote about local governments and their authority or lack of same in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Last week, a federal judge in California overturned a Trump administration decision to remove gray wolves from the list of endangered species. This newest ruling means Wisconsin is no longer allowed to hold a gray wolf hunt. The state held a hunt a year ago. Another hunt scheduled for last fall was postponed under a court injunction. We're learning more about what the ruling means for hunters, farmers, and the gray wolf population in the state. Peter David is a wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Another in a long line of court rulings and federal decisions. Peter, what were the reasons this judge in California gave saying, yeah, we need to restore these federal protections for gray wolves?
Well, you know, there are really a number of different reasons that he considered. But the biggest one seemed to be that it really didn't seem to consider the threats to wolves outside of the Great Lakes and the Northern Rockies. And it didn't really address language in the Endangered Species Act about the loss of significant portions of the historic range of wolves.
That's been kind of a central part of this whole discussion, right? The idea that one standard says once we hit X number of gray wolves, we've got a sustainable population. Another that says, yeah, but as you were just saying, they're not in many of their historical ranges. That seems like it's been a lot of the core of the debate, even among conservationists.
Well, you know, we've seen this go back and forth. This is the fifth time now that wolves have been delisted and relisted. And Wisconsin sort of gets tied into this because we tend to look at this issue from a very local scale. Mm-hmm. But we're really a small part of the big picture of wolf restoration on a national scale. And so we kind of go tugged by the tides of that bigger argument.
Now, this ruling from a judge affects different states differently, if I'm reading it right, Peter. So for some Rocky Mountain states with more established populations, there is leeway for hunting, but not here in the Great Lakes area.
That's right. That northern Rocky Mountain population was carved out really by congressional action. And so this ruling by the judge didn't change their status. But the ruling that went into effect, the delisting that took place about 13 months ago, affected states from Maine to California. And so all of those states, again, are reverting back to the status that they had prior to being delisted. So in Wisconsin, from a practical purpose, that means that there will be no hunting or trapping seasons in the state as long as wolves remain under the Endangered Species Act. Also in Wisconsin and Michigan, there will be no lethal control by government agents or by members of the public, except in the instances of legitimate human health and safety situations, which are extremely rare. It is a little bit different in Minnesota because wolves have reverted to a status there of being threatened rather than endangered. Lethal depredation control of wolves in that state will continue to go on as it has for decades.
Now, that's one concern. You said danger to humans in the state. Some dairy farmers in particular, I know, are concerned about livestock depredation. How big a problem is this? What are the concerns if farmers can't, as you say, kill wolves in cases of livestock depredation?
Well, that is an issue that has been a concern to the ag industry for a long time. There are certainly a number of other steps that can be used. There are both non-lethal and preventative actions that can be taken. And it's interesting to compare Wisconsin to Minnesota. Because Wisconsin has been listed as endangered for a long time, there's been many periods of time when only non-lethal control was in effect here, unlike Minnesota. And what's been curious is that it seems like wolf depredations haven't increased in proportion to the wolf population, which seems to be more the case in Minnesota. And it's really hard to be sure what the difference is, but some have suggested that the use of non-lethal in Wisconsin is actually educating wolves how to get along better with people. Whereas in our adjacent state, depredating wolves are simply killed, so no learning takes place, and new naive wolves can move into that same area and perhaps just sort of recreate a cycle of loss.
Peter David is with us, wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, talking about the latest chapter now when it comes to gray wolves here in Wisconsin. A judge ruled that the gray wolf should be on the Endangered Species Act, overturning a Trump administration decision. Now hunting for gray wolves is, under this ruling, off here in Wisconsin. Peter, I know deer hunters are concerned. People who are worried about the deer population are concerned in different ways. Can you talk about the role of gray wolves on the deer in affecting the deer population here in the state?
Yeah, well, this is such a common topic of discourse, I guess, in the wolf world. Because wolves definitely do eat deer, and so many people sort of jump to the conclusion that they have a negative impact on the deer herd. In fact, on any sort of a landscape level, there's very little evidence to suggest that wolves regulate the number of deer on the landscape. And in fact, it's probably the other way around. The number of deer you have determines the number of wolves you can have. We do know that wolves are very selective. Taking a deer is not an easy thing. And so they focus on the sick, the injured, the aged, the weak. And to that role, they really seem to have a critical long-term role in maintaining health, actually, in the deer herd. And in Wisconsin, where we have a tremendous issue, for example, with chronic wasting disease, there's good reason to think that wolves might actually be one of the most effective tools we have to control that disease. So when you place wolves in this bigger landscape and you look at all of the other things that affect deer populations on the landscape, human harvest, weather, vehicle accidents, other predators, it's really clear that wolves are not driving the deer population. And in fact, really do help maintain its health when you especially look at this in the long term.
As I mentioned, Peter, we didn't have that fall hunt. That's that was kind of in limbo for a while there. We had that hunt last year, February. The hunt exceeded the intended quota by quite a bit, killed a lot more wolves than planned. Are we starting to see how that has affected the overall population of wolves in the state now?
You know, we really haven't yet, but hopefully within a few months we will. That hunt was unlike any wolf hunt really anywhere in history by being nestled entirely within the wolves' brief breeding season. And so the impact of taking a wolf at that time of the year is really more impactful than at any other time. And we don't know. We don't have any precursor, I guess, to suggest what those impacts will be. But we know that certainly pregnant wolves were taken. And even taking males or other pack members can be important because it affects the recruitment of the pups into that population. But this is the time of year right now that population data is being gathered. That will continue for a couple of more months. And once that's all compiled, we'll have, again, a first idea of what the impact of that February season was actually on the population.
Were we unique here in Wisconsin as far as Great Lakes states having gray wolf hunts over the last couple of years?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Both of our adjacent states that we share this population with did not jump into having a season. The discretion for that season was left to the State Department of Natural Resources, unlike the case in Wisconsin. And I will add that the Wisconsin DNR was not promoting that February season, but was pushed into it by the lawsuit that took place. In the other two states, I think we're seeing a very measured response to the delisting that took place. They talked to the tribes in those states. They talked to their stakeholders and the public. They conducted social surveys, and they're developing updates to their management plans, as Wisconsin is, to figure out really the best path forward. It's pretty clear we're not doing a great job oftentimes post-delisting, and hopefully we can find a better way to go forward, unlike that what really happened in February here in Wisconsin.
Now, I think everybody's who's been following this issue is used to this sort of, you know, watching the tennis ball bounce back and forth. This is a court ruling. What are you watching for next, Peter, to see if this stands?
Well, that's a good question. I think the first thing will really be is how will the Fish and Wildlife Service respond to this? My understanding is they had 60 days from the rule to decide whether they want to appeal or not. I'm not privy to where they are in that decision. Mm-hmm. I'll be a little bit surprised if they would appeal it. But that'll be certainly the first thing everyone will be watching to see what happens.
And I've seen some talk of maybe Midwest lawmakers, and there's some bipartisan support for this idea, I think, Peter, of saying, hey, let's advance legislation and get a carve out like they have in those northern Rocky Mountain states. Actually, Congress passing a law to say the wolf population is established enough in the Midwest. We're going to take away the power from the Fish and Wildlife Service on this one. Is that something you expect to see an effort on?
Well, I certainly hope not. That's in my personal mind, just a bad way of regulating wildlife. It really is an effort to undercut the power of the Endangered Species Act, which is one of the most important tools we have to protect species that are threatened. And if you're going to do it for wolves, there's really no saying where that type of an approach might end. And so that's a big concern, I think, that goes well beyond the range of wolves. And certainly I'll say the last delisting, you know, it was interesting. There were several states that were included amongst people opposed to the delisting that took place. And so I think the public at large has actually come a long way into being supportive of having healthy and robust and ecologically functional wolf populations on the landscape. And it's really taking, I think, in some cases, the Department of Natural Resources and certainly the legislatures in those states to sort of catch up to the desires of the public.
Peter, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Take care, and we'll talk again someday.
All right. Peter David is a wildlife biologist for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He was with us today talking about federal protections for gray wolves and what it means here in Wisconsin.